طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature the first of what will be several presentations recorded at the conference titled Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, held on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. The conference was sponsored by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine and the Trans-Arab Research Institute. The quality of the presentations was incredible, and we want to bring you as many of them as possible over the next several weeks on This Week in Palestine. We begin this morning with the keynote address delivered by Youssef Munayer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights.
Thank you so much for that very kind introduction, Elaine. Let me begin by saying that all of us can be inspired by what is a truly dynamic young generation of activists and scholars working on Palestine. But this is a generation that follows in the footsteps of those who came before us, like Elaine, like Nasir Haruri, and like so many more who have given us the foundation from which to take our struggle forward. It's a pleasure and honor to be able to join you here for this important conference. I want to thank the organizers and attendees who are making this success possible, and I was happy to accept the invitation to deliver this address today. I will discuss Palestine rights work in the United States under the presidency of Donald Trump. Before we can appreciate the work that lies ahead of us, however, it's important to first understand the pre-existing context we operated in ahead of this Trumpian moment. Our organization is a coalition of over 300 member groups across the United States working for Palestinian rights. Founded in 2001, the U.S. campaign included organizations large and small, many of them represented in this room, of various identities and in various locations across the country. Prior to the advent of the BDS call in 2005, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions call, which I believe we are all familiar with in this room, the U.S. campaign was engaged in efforts to end U.S. military aid to Israel by focusing on Washington, D.C. Our organization is also part of a movement for Palestinian rights inside the United States and out. In the U.S. in particular, the Palestinian rights movement has a rich history which predates the establishment of Israel and was largely conducted by Arab American organizations for many decades. Advocacy for Palestinian rights relied on many traditional tactics, including educational and informational campaigns aimed at public opinion as well as congressional advocacy. Here it's important to say a word about the U.S.-Israel relationship. As you know, the movement for Palestinian rights is a global one, and it's important to send Israel a message from every corner of the globe that its denial of Palestinian rights is unacceptable. However, not all relationships are created equal. The U.S.-Israel relationship, more than Israel's relationship with any other country or group of countries, is the single most important relationship that Israel has. Washington's support for Israel is the very backbone of Israel's abuses. Without American support, it's hard to imagine how Israel could continue to employ its abusive policies. For this reason, our work here in the United States is both of great consequence, but is also very challenging. Just as we know the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship, so too do Israel's supporters and allies who are working to maintain the status of this relationship. Pro-Israel interest groups have invested heavily in developing and maintaining relations between Washington and Tel Aviv for decades. Thus, the traditional channels of advocacy, particularly as it relates to policy change, are extremely difficult for us to navigate. I cannot tell you the number of times members of Congress or their staff have privately, and even sometimes publicly, told Palestine rights advocates, "I agree with you, but if I did anything on this, it would cost me dearly." The extent to which a Zionist consensus exists on Capitol Hill would make you think that it is not a hill in Washington, D.C., but an Israeli colonized hilltop in the West Bank. No matter how many letters were written to Congress, how many phone calls were made by constituents to members' offices, the efforts often came up empty. This, of course, had a very discouraging and demoralizing effect on activists engaged in Palestinian rights advocacy. So it was in this context that the BDS call arrived onto the scene. While the idea of divestment existed before 2005, and indeed divestment campaigns were being organized and even won on campuses prior to the 2005 call. Shout out to Hampshire College here in Massachusetts, who succeeded back in 2004. The call, nonetheless, 12 years ago, formalized the use of these tactics in a Palestinian-led framework for the first time. It's no exaggeration to say that the embrace of these tactics by Palestinian rights activists in the United States had a revolutionary impact on the movement. The call gave activists new ways to organize, new spaces to organize in, new targets to aim for, and, most importantly, an opportunity to win. Perhaps it was too difficult at the moment to get the U.S. government to address its complicity in Israeli abuses. But what about the complicity of various levels in society below the government level? There is the individual, community, organizational, institutional, and local government complicity that could be addressed by campaigns with specific targets. These campaigns could operate in an arena with far less competition than in the halls of Congress, making them imminently more winnable. This quickly translated to optimism, engagement, buy-in, commitment, and the desire to do more campaign-related work. Suddenly, an effort that had become debilitating and discouraging became dynamic, energizing, and empowering instead. In the United States, BDS campaigns have seen numerous successes in the past 12 years. On our website, you can view a list of all of the victories that have been amassed over this time. Two things immediately jump out when looking at this list. First, the sheer diversity of victories is impressive. Corporate divestment victories, church divestment, cultural boycott, university boycott, professional association boycott or divestment victories, and the list goes on. Second, the accelerated pace of these victories over time. In the early years after the call, victories were less prevalent, but in recent years they've been increasingly frequent as the use of these tactics grows. Our organization used to spend more time helping groups start campaigns, but now we do a lot less of that. Self-starting campaigns take off around the country, sometimes thanks to pre-existing resources, but often also out of the initiative of local organizers. Now, much more of our work and our time is spent coordinating and providing support for campaigns that are up and running on their own. So now that we've discussed the context as it relates to the great growth of the movement, it's important to understand the political context in the United States ahead of the election that brought us Donald Trump and the space it afforded for Palestinian rights work. During the Obama era, despite his stalwart support for Israel on par or beyond any of his predecessors, we witnessed an unprecedented shift in public opinion on Israel in the United States that largely followed partisan lines. This is significant because in American politics, even when Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree on whether it was night or day outside, they always, always agreed on Israel. Now, suddenly, this was starting to change. This change took place for several reasons that are very important to understand. The first was Obama the person. Barack Hussein Obama was elected the first black president of the United States, but to many in Israel, they could not get past his middle name, or the fact that his father was a Muslim, or that he spent time in Indonesia growing up, or that he had a dinner conversation once with Edward Said and was acquainted with Rashid Khalidi. Obama was also viewed with suspicion at the highest levels of the Israeli government because it was believed that Obama sympathized with the Palestinian narrative more than the Israeli narrative. The second factor was Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu's premiership in Israel essentially overlapped with Obama's presidency for all but a few months. Each government Netanyahu formed was a right-wing government strongly supportive of settlement expansion, which caused friction with Obama's Washington as they spoke of advancing peace negotiations. This tension was evident from the outset of the relationship between the two leaders, and Netanyahu's way of dealing with it was to change the subject away from peace, settlements, and Palestinian rights to Iran, 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 and did I mention Iran as well? This brings us to the third important factor in the partisan divide. That is the Iran deal. Obama viewed the region in a way that the Israelis did not like. He sought to stabilize it not through massive deployment, but through the pursuit of political agreements, and he saw an opening with Iran that allowed him to pursue the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which would bring Iran in line with its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. While this would result in an unprecedented inspections regime on Tehran's nuclear program, the likes of which the world had not seen, it would also mean that the Iranian government would be given a path out of the isolation the international community had imposed on it. Netanyahu and many in Israel who see no option other than the eventual regime change in Iran viewed this as a mistake and worked as hard as possible to torpedo the Iran deal. With nuclear nonproliferation being highest on Obama's national security agenda, the Iran deal would be a significant policy achievement that advanced American national security interests while also keeping a promise he had made on the campaign trail about the willingness to talk to the Iranians and advance relations out of mutual respect. The fight over the Iran deal was on, and it was a vicious one that quickly became hyperpartisan. For Obama's opponents, some of whom had accused the president of being too kind to American adversaries, and others who even claimed he was not an American and seeking to subvert it from the inside, the politics around the Iran deal was fuel for their fire. Many of Obama's supporters, though, not only agreed with the Iran deal for its national security objectives, but they also grew angry at allegations of traitorism against their president, which they saw as often racially coded language. Let me say a few words about these narratives. Pro-Israel advocacy in the United States has always come not just from Jewish Zionist voices or institutions, but from evangelical Zionist ones as well, a demographic that has for generations been at the base of the Republican Party. But it was more recently, during the two Bush administrations, that this constituency really started to flex its muscles. The confluence of multiple American wars in Muslim countries, 9/11, the War on Terror, and the Second Intifada helped sew together a clash of civilizations narrative that dominated the political discourse on the right and beyond. The discourse was clear about the axes of good and evil. Predominantly white, Judeo-Christian civilization was on one side, and Islam was on the other. Enter Hussein Obama, the first African-American president and the first physical manifestation of the minority-majority American future. Among the immediate reactions to Obama's triumph was birtherism, the Tea Party, and the narrative that undergirded both. Obama is not one of us. But these reactionary movements shared this core analysis with a more intellectual-seeming group. In right-wing neoconservative circles, the same narrative was congealing around Obama and one core issue, Israel. Take, for example, a book published in 2009 by National Review writer Michael Ledeen, which gave Obama a whole 8 months before rendering the verdict very clearly. The book was titled Obama's Betrayal of Israel. For others, where the verdict on Obama was still out, one question loomed large. Does Obama really feel it in the kishkis for Israel? Obama, of course, was as pro-Israel as any of his predecessors, but that didn't stop certain pro-Israel voices on the right, like Charles Krauthammer, who argued in a column titled, It's Obama versus Israel. Searching for the source of Obama's hatred of Israel, Krauthammer wondered if it stemmed from Obama's penchant for appeasing enemies while beating up on allies, or perhaps it was because Obama wanted to heal the breach between Christianity and Islam and has little patience for this pesky Jewish state. Over at the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol told us that Obama was angry, accelerating both his appeasement of Iran and his attacks on Israel. But there was good news. The Republican Party, he writes, and the conservative movement and most of the American people stand with Israel against President Obama. Crystal also set up something called the Emergency Committee for Israel, a right-wing attack operation intended to counterbalance J Street, which was seen as giving Obama Jewish cover. What was the emergency? It was Hussein Obama, just as the robocalls supporting Netanyahu's re-election in Israel had called him. The Emergency Committee for Israel has now changed its name to the Committee for Israel since the election. I'm not joking. They've literally declared the emergency over now that the first black president has been replaced by the white supremacist in chief. Then you have Bret Stephens, who argued that Obama not only betrayed Israel, but that he had systematically failed to oppose every adversary, from the Iranian regime to Bashar al-Assad to Russia to the Muslim Brotherhood. And who did Bret Stephens say was most betrayed by President Obama, the first African-American president? Americans. This narrative flowed back and forth between these voices on the right, like Robert Spencer or Dick Cheney or Sean Hannity or Alan West, who wrote, for example, "The barbarians are indeed at the gate, but there are also traitors within our ranks. If Barack Obama goes to the United Nations Security Council and drops the veto in support for the two-state solution, I believe we will see the latter enable the former." Likewise, Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich, two of the President Trump's early supporters, helped carry the tune of dog whistles. Gingrich argued that Obama is so outside of our comprehension, he can only be understood by knowing Kenyan anti-colonial behavior. Mike Huckabee told Fox News viewers, "Everything Obama does is against what Christians stand for. He's against the Jews in Israel. Furthermore," he argued, "the one group of people that can know they have his undying, unfailing support would be the Muslim community. And it doesn't matter whether it's the radical Muslim community or the more moderate Muslim community." But opposing Obama on Israel had a deeper impact than these pundits may have reckoned with. And it is well illustrated in an episode from 2016 involving Jennifer Rubin, who wrote a Washington Post column called "Why It's Correct to Label the Obama Administration Anti-Israel." She concluded that the Obama administration was the most anti-Israel in history and a disloyal, unhelpful ally. But her article, which was typical of her output during the 8 years of Obama's presidency, had a ripple effect. It was amplified on a website called Breitbart News, which Steve Bannon called the platform of the alt-right, precisely because it reinforced their narrative. In other words, the white supremacist home base saw no contradiction between Rubin's analysis of Obama and Israel and their own worldview. And this is exactly the point. Not only did these pundits not contradict the ideological undercurrent of the alt-right, they provided a piece of the paradigm with their insistence over and over again on an us versus them mentality. The fight over the Iran deal, during which much of this narrative swirled, put Israel, Republicans, Islamophobes, and racists of various stripes on one side, and the president, Democrats, multiculturalists on another. It came to a climax when then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured an invitation to speak before a joint session of Congress through the Republican Speaker of the House, circumventing the White House purely for the purpose of lobbying against the president's agenda. This meant that the Republican Speaker of the House was cooperating with a foreign leader in an effort to derail the signature foreign policy objective of the American president. As a result, a stunning 60 members of Congress, senators and representatives alike, almost all Democrats, chose to skip the speech of Benjamin Netanyahu and held press conferences instead explaining why they did so. Many of them were members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The speech of an Israeli prime minister before the American Congress is a sickening display, which has become known for featuring more standing ovations than the annual State of the Union address delivered by the president himself. So for 60 members of Congress to skip out on this high-profile address was a stunning rebuke for Netanyahu and a sign of the times. So this brings us to the fourth factor driving the partisan divide, an important one during the Obama era, and perhaps even more important during the Trump era, which is now upon us. And that is what Obama represented. Barack Hussein Obama represented a changing America, a majority-minority country which was headed in the direction of more people of color assuming decision-making roles. Obama represented a certain ethos that would be at the center of the political battle boiling in the next election. That ethos is one of civic belonging, one that prioritizes democracy over identity. American as an idea, not a color, ethnicity, or religion. America does not cease to exist if it no longer has a white Christian majority. The same cannot be said for the Israeli ethos, however. This is an ethos that prioritizes identity over democracy. Obama represented an America that was becoming more demographically diverse and was okay with it, or so we thought. Israel, on the other hand, considers demographic changes to be existential threats. This contrast became clear in the Obama era, and it became clearer still in the Trump era. So this brings us to the election just over a year ago today. The last American presidential election was probably the most covered and most followed political contest in modern history. It was a campaign unlike any other we had seen in the United States, pitting the most insider of insiders in Hillary Clinton against the most unorthodox of outsiders in Donald J. Trump. Neither of them was particularly good on Palestine or a friend to BDS. Hillary Clinton made a commitment on the campaign trail to combat the BDS movement, in large part as a response to her largest donor, Haim Saban, who has made fighting BDS a priority. Donald Trump's pro-Israel bona fides were laid out at the annual AIPAC conference and in many statements before and after. We prepared for a Clinton presidency. Why? Because every poll and almost every analyst had her winning comfortable. And frankly, how on earth could one prepare for a Trump presidency even if you thought he was going to win? Everyone knew Clinton was a vulnerable candidate. She entered into the contest as the only nominee in Democratic Party history to have an unfavorable rating above 50%. She was running against an opponent, however, who had an unfavorable rating close to 60%. While Trump may have been the only candidate Clinton could beat, the inverse was likely also true. How convinced were we that Clinton was going to win? We had an email prepared to go out to our supporters, loaded up, to blast out to tens of thousands of people, saying something to the effect of, "Clinton has won, what is next for BDS?" One of the challenges we expected to arise that would impact our work should Clinton win would be the rollback of this partisan divide on Israel. We imagined that Clinton, who had committed to inviting Netanyahu to the White House in her first 100 days, would reset relations with Israel and make clear that there was no partisan divide. With Hussein Obama now out of the way, business as usual in the U.S.-Israel relationship would return. But of course, Clinton did not win, and we got Trump instead. We wrote a different email. While we were not expecting Trump, we were forced to begin thinking about how our work would change under a Trump presidency. Our initial thinking was heavily influenced by the sheer shock of what took place. Not only was the outcome a surprise, but what this outcome could mean could be devastating. Aside from the pernicious policies Trump supported towards immigrants, refugees, and the outside world in general, he rode to power on a wave of nativist, xenophobic white nationalism that would continue to be empowered after his victory. Trump had won despite making attacking the press a cornerstone of his campaigning, and he was surrounded by some key advisors who had a clash of civilizations mindset that advocated for eternal war with Islam. Some think tanks friendly to Trump had made combating BDS a priority, including through attacking Muslim American organizations that practice BDS, like American Muslims for Palestine, one of our coalition groups who has recently come under the crosshairs of legal targeting. And while he continued to attack minorities, he also continued to embrace Israel, and in particular, Benjamin Netanyahu. Take, for example, his behavior this past December when he was president-elect and the UN Security Council was voting on a resolution to condemn settlements that Obama ultimately permitted to pass by withholding his veto. Netanyahu worked to stop the resolution, and when the White House refused to commit to veto it, Netanyahu called Trump. Trump then called Egypt's el-Sisi, whose ambassador had introduced the resolution, and Egypt withdrew it. However, four other countries were prepared to move ahead with it, and the vote ultimately happened with a U.S. abstention. Trump, as he always does, let his thoughts be known to the world on Twitter, slamming the Obama administration for throwing Israel under the bus and promising that things would be different come January 20th which was Inauguration Day. He had also promised to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem during this time. Netanyahu properly thanked him for his support on Twitter and looked forward to the new relationship. Soon, these two tweeting lovebirds would continue to exchange public messages of support. When President Trump made clear he wanted to build an even bigger wall to prevent immigrants from coming to the United States from Mexico, Netanyahu tweeted that Israel built a wall and walls work. Trump would soon cite him in a TV interview. Shortly after inauguration, it was announced that Netanyahu would be the first foreign leader to officially visit the White House after Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom. Netanyahu's trip was planned for February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day. The Love Fest provided us an opportunity. Trump was a remarkably unpopular figure in the United States and only becoming more despised, particularly among Democrats, including those who did not support Palestinian rights or BDS. Being in opposition to Trump is where all the energy, power, and dynamism was, and being able to brand Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu as Trump allies was a way to continue to open eyes in progressive and liberal circles in the United States. These two leaders were largely doing the work for us. But we took pleasure in launching the Bad Romance campaign, which was timed around Netanyahu's Valentine's Day visit to the White House. This video and petition campaign shed light on the common agenda between Netanyahu and Trump, as well as the chummy support they showed each other in curtailing the rights of darker-skinned people under their rule. Additionally, the Trump-Netanyahu love affair sent a shock through much of the American Jewish community, which votes overwhelmingly liberal. Trump's campaign brought all sorts of white nationalists out of the woodwork, leading to a spike in both Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents. Yet at the press conference between both leaders, the leader of the so-called State of the Jewish People provided backing when Trump faced the question about his campaign's role in fueling anti-Semitism. This showed what many of us had known for a very long time, that Zionism had a tolerance for anti-Semitism, and it was the idea that acted as its very raison d'etre. This attitude was once again on display this summer, when Netanyahu's government retracted a statement condemning an anti-Semitic ad targeting George Soros, an Israel critic and philanthropist, in Hungary. Or when Netanyahu's son, Yair, or the head of the Israeli-American coalition, Adam Milstein, shared social media memes attacking critics of Israel using anti-Semitic tropes. The concert between Zionism, anti-Semitism, ethno-nationalism, and nativist racism is particularly appropriate to discuss as we reflect on the topic of this conference, the legacy of Arthur Balfour. Though he may be most known for aiding Zionists in 1917, it's crucial to remember that Arthur Balfour was, in fact, a white supremacist. He made that much clear in his own words. In 1906, the House of Commons in the UK was engaged in a debate about whether or not the native black population in South Africa should have a right to vote. Most members of Parliament agreed that the disenfranchisement of blacks was evil, but not Arthur Balfour, who almost alone argued against it. "We have to face the facts," Balfour said. "Men are not born equal. The white and black races are not born with equal capacities. They are born with different capacities, which education cannot and will not change." But Balfour's troubling views, of course, were not limited to Africa. In fact, despite his now iconic support for Zionism, he was not exactly a friend to the Jews. In the late 19th century, pogroms targeting Jews in the Pale of Settlement had led to waves of Jewish flight westward to England and the United States. This influx of refugees led to an increase in British anti-immigrant racism and outright anti-Semitism, themes that are not unfamiliar to our politics today. Support for political action against immigrants grew as the English public demanded immigration control to keep certain immigrants, particularly Jews, out of the country. In 1905, while serving as Prime Minister, Balfour presided over the passage of the Aliens Act. This legislation put the first restrictions on immigration into Great Britain, and it was primarily aimed at restricting Jewish immigration. It may seem astonishing that Balfour, whose support for the Zionist cause has made him a hero among many Jews, would have implemented anti-Jewish laws. But the truth is, his support for Zionism stemmed from the exact same source as his desire to limit Jewish immigration into Britain. Both can be traced back to his white supremacist beliefs. Balfour lived in an era of stirring nationalism, highly defined by ethno-religious identity. Because of these sentiments, the early 20th century was a time when ostensibly liberal Western nations struggled with the challenge of incorporating Jewish citizens. What the Zionists provided for Balfour was a solution to the challenges Jewish citizens posed to his ethno-nationalist vision, a solution that didn't force him to reckon with them. Instead of insisting that societies accept all citizens as equals, regardless of racial or religious background, the Zionist movement offered a different answer: separation. Balfour saw in Zionism not just a blessing for the Jews, but a blessing for the West as well. And he wrote in 1919 that the Zionist movement would, quote, mitigate the age-long miseries created for Western civilization by the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it equally was unable to expel or absorb. By both giving Jews a place to go and a place to leave, Zionism seemingly solved two problems at once. In Balfour's mind, in other words, his support for Zionism was motivated to an extent by his desire to protect Britain from the negative effects of the, quote, miseries of having Jews in its midst. Rather than protecting the rights of one of its minorities, Britain could simply encourage exporting them, or at least not import anymore. Needless to say, his view of Zionism is steeped in the same kind of white supremacy as his views on South Africa's blacks. But his support for the Zionist dream had another problem. Rather than solving the problem of how to handle a minority living in a white-majority country, the Balfour Declaration just shifted the same problem into a different geography. For the tension between ethno-nationalism and equality is equally present today between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, where the Israeli state rules over the fate of millions of Palestinians who either have no right to vote, are treated as second-class citizens, or are refugees denied repatriation. Today, it is Israel that views Palestinians, like myself, as demographic threats, and sees, quote, the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it was equally unable to expel or absorb. That Balfour's legacy of supremacy persists as much as British support for Israel is no accident. We have arrived at this point today because the supremacist attitudes of Balfour informed policy, lending imperial might to the pursuit of a project for national self-determination for Jews by trampling on the rights of native non-Jews. Remarkably, Balfour was unabashedly aware of the hypocrisy of his stance. Quote, the weak point of our position, of course, is that in the case of Palestine, we deliberately and rightly decline to accept the principle of self-determination, he wrote in 1919. We do not propose to even go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country, the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. Those Arabs, of course, made up 90% of the population, if not more. My grandparents, along with, I'm sure, the relatives of many in this room were among them. Therein lies the fundamental problem that continues through this day, 100 years later. Palestinians are denied the right to have rights because from the very outset, their views, their human rights, and by extension, their very humanity were consistently seen as inferior to those of others. That was clear in Balfour's perspective and the British Mandate's policy, and it persists in one form or another in the many policies of the Israeli state through this day. Today, as much as in 1917, the battle between ethno-nationalism and equality, between particularism and universalism, has risen to the foreground, from Donald Trump's rise in America to Theresa May's Brexited Britain. Rather than resolving this tension, Balfour's support for Zionism merely exported it to Palestine. The ideology that Trump rode into power favored a very similar Herrenvolk nationalism. It holds that a country is for a people, not for many peoples. Zionism fits this worldview very well. Exposing this to those in liberal and progressive circles in the United States who have not yet taken a stand on Palestinian rights will be one of our key tasks in the Trump era. Moving forward, we must do several things. First, we must build towards the S. While we have had success over the past 12 years in many B and D campaigns, there is much work yet to do to getting to the S, the sanctions. Israel's U.S. government-level sanctions on Israel would be a game-changer. And we should not shy away from or be intimidated by this objective. Rather, we must assess what it takes to get to this goal, be realistic about the time that it will take to get there, build the power necessary to march down this path, and do so unapologetically. This is a longer-term objective, and while it is unclear exactly how long it will take, it is clear that it is beyond 3 to 5 years. The question for us in the Trump era is how best to build towards this ultimate goal in the political context we operate in during this period. Now I want to outline challenges and opportunities on this path that we will encounter and will feature heavily in our work in the years to come. First, and perhaps most importantly, we must intersectionally organize. Something very important happened in the summer of 2014. As you all know, that summer, Israel bombarded Gaza for 55 hellish days, killing well over 2,000 Palestinians, most of whom, as always, were civilians. The war on Gaza received massive coverage in the United States, albeit primarily filtered through a pro-Israel lens, and was the lead story on almost every day of the summer and in every newscast. But what may be less known outside the United States is that in the second week of August, just as the war in Gaza was beginning to wind down, attention in the United States turned to the story of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old African-American from Ferguson, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. The unarmed Brown was shot to death by a white police officer and had his hands up at the time of the shooting. The case recentered the discussion about police brutality in the United States and the legacy of racism in American institutions, especially in law enforcement. But the fact that it came during the war on Gaza meant that those following the news, both on traditional and social media, were confronted by a striking juxtaposition. State violence aimed at upholding a system of injustice on the other side of the world and in our own backyard. As protesters gathered in the streets of Missouri only to be met with a harsh police response, activists from Palestine sent messages with tips on how to mitigate the influence of tear gas. Others circulated images of identical tear gas canisters used 6,000 miles apart, made by the same corporation in Pennsylvania. Palestinian keffiyehs could be seen in the streets of Ferguson during the protests. The connections were just too prevalent to ignore. This episode highlights one of the many intersectional organizing opportunities that offer a path to building coalitions with groups and movements who are unaware of our work and afford us an opportunity to support their work as well. There are intersections with Palestinian rights issues and various other issues of importance in the United States, including some that have come to the fore in the recent years and months after Trump. For example, did you know that the company that helped build Israel's wall in the West Bank and helped encage Gaza is considered to be the front runner for the contract to expand Trump's wall to keep immigrants out? Or that G4S, which has long been a BDS target, is deeply enmeshed in the American prison industrial complex? Long before Donald Trump banned refugees, Israel had its own refugee ban, preventing many of my family members, for example, from returning to their homeland. As awareness of communities of color coming into the crosshairs of state policy and rhetoric grows, the opportunities to create alliances, coalitions, and insert the issue of Palestinian rights firmly into the fold of progressive and liberal priorities continues to grow as well. Second, we must work to reform an anti-lobbying culture. An unfortunate byproduct of the success of BDS tactics is that it's directed grassroots energy away from focused engagement with policymakers in the federal government. As activists get used to working on divestment campaigns targeting either a corporation or aiming for a resolution in this church or that university, they're honing organizing skills for those campaigns while not developing lobbying skills needed for effective government engagement. As I noted earlier, BDS tactics provided something of a refuge for activists who were tired of getting nowhere with Congress, but here's the hard truth. There is no way to sanctions without going through Congress. This means that at some point that engagement needs to happen, and the sooner it starts, the better. This is not to say there's no engagement with lawmakers. There is. But there can certainly be much more, and there will have to be much more for us to achieve the goals we want to see, and the anti-lobbying culture that has arisen as a byproduct of focused B and D work makes this more difficult. Addressing this culture and correcting it will be a big task for us in the years ahead. Third, we must confront lawfare. An additional challenge we've been confronting in the United States, and I know there's going to be a workshop on this afternoon, is the lawfare efforts aimed at repressing the Palestinian rights movement by attempting to criminalize BDS tactics. We have seen multiple pieces of legislation in state legislatures across the United States aimed at this purpose over the last 2 years, and we have organized local coalitions to fight them, with success in some areas, but not in all. As a group of organizations with relatively small capacity in comparison to what we are up against, we must be careful not to get bogged down fighting anti-BDS legislation to the point where it is all-consuming. Tying us up playing defense so that we are incapable of playing offense and burning out our resources is precisely what our adversaries would like to see. At the same time, we cannot ignore such legislation. We must triage the situation and strategically address state legislation where we can. We are working with other groups to educate activists about their rights, which is a key component to defeating the chilling effect that these laws intend to inspire. While we do have President Trump, we also still have the Constitution, at least for now. What is so important about this is that unlike places like France, for example, where the state can take draconian steps against BDS activity, political boycotts are considered free expression and protected here under the First Amendment to the Constitution and have been upheld as such by the Supreme Court of the United States. For this reason, anti-BDS laws in the United States can only go so far before crossing a constitutional line that would open them to legal challenge in the courts. We have noticed that anti-BDS law drafters have attempted to tiptoe up to this line in some places, but elsewhere have crossed it, almost testing to see how much they can get away with. Legal challenges have already begun. This summer, an important battle against a piece of federal legislation called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act began. As written, it could lead to civil and even criminal penalties for BDS-type activities, with up to $1 million fine and 20 years in prison. We have seen the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, join alongside us to defeat this legislation. This is very important for several reasons. First, while we have been screaming at the top of our lungs about the unconstitutional nature of these bills, few took notice until the ACLU weighed in. Second, the ACLU is a very well-respected organization, particularly in liberal circles, and the fact that they have taken up this cause sends an important political message. Third, since the inauguration of President Trump and his attempts at instituting various rights-infringing policies, the ACLU has been a key institutional leader in opposing these policies, like the Muslim ban, for example. Once the ACLU weighed in, senators came under increased pressure to end their sponsorship of this anti-BDS legislation, and many have already expressed willingness to amend it or withdraw from it. It's not clear if this legislation would have ever come up for a vote. However, the legislation provided an opportunity to expose the repressive lawfare effort to a much wider audience. Now more people are becoming aware that Israel and its allies are actually trying to silence criticism of Israeli policy overseas. This very authoritarian tactic cuts against the ostensibly democratic ally Israel claims to be when it otherwise engages American audiences. Continuing to expose these repressive efforts in partnership with institutions that have been leaders in protecting free expression will be an important feature of our work moving forward. Lastly, we must work to build congressional support. We must work to build support in Congress for standing up for Palestinian rights. In recent years, we've seen important gains in this area, even though the energy of the movement has been more campaign-focused and not focused on the engagement of government. Last year, for example, 19 members of Congress signed a letter led by Representative Betty McCollum to the Secretary of State demanding steps be taken to protect Palestinian children whose rights are abused by Israeli policies. The letter even called for holding Israeli military units accountable under the Leahy Law, a provision which would deny aid or training to those units. This may seem unremarkable, but consider that 10 years ago, it was difficult to get even 5 members to sign a letter urging continued support for humanitarian aid to Gaza through UNRWA. Now we have 19 willing to sign on for conditioning aid. This year we worked on a similar letter calling for the protection of Isa Amro, a Palestinian rights defender who is being targeted by the Israeli military court system and is being forced to face trial on bogus charges. We were hoping we could get 25 names on a letter calling on the Secretary of State to advocate on his behalf and noting that the Israeli military courts are kangaroo courts with a 99% conviction rate. This advocacy campaign resulted in 34 members of Congress signing this letter. These numbers will continue to grow, and it is one of our main responsibilities to grow them. First, there will be letters, then there will be the introduction of legislation. Keep your eyes open for that very soon, and keep in mind, the first comprehensive sanctions bill for South Africa was introduced in 1972. It took 14 years before it could pass. But with unprecedented numbers of members taking steps to defy the intimidation of pro-Israel lobby groups, we find today the energy to redouble our efforts and continue to build. As their numbers grow, more numbers will feel safe in joining. We must work to build a core, first among progressive Democrats and then into the mainstream of American politics, that supports Palestinian rights, because Palestinian rights are as important as the rights of any other group. It's a long battle ahead, but it is a right battle. And I am proud and honored to play a role in it alongside so many of you around the world who want to see freedom, justice, and equality for us here in the United States and not last in Palestine. Thank you.
You have been listening to Yusuf Munayer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, delivering the keynote address at the conference on the Balfour Declaration. And that is our program this morning. Tune in again next week for more presentations from the Balfour Legacy Conference held in Cambridge on November 11th. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.